We're going to open tonight's discussion with an introduction in turn of our three panelists. Ask them in about 5 minutes to summarize their worldviews, what their core beliefs are, how those beliefs guide their daily lives, to the extent that they do, if they do. And we'll start with my friend and colleague, Robert Thurman. You've read the introductory materials on him, but let me highlight that he was named in 1997 as one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential people. He's often regarded as the preeminent expert on Buddhism here in America, and he will offer his introduction.
Good evening, everyone. I was, I have to confess, I had forgotten that there were questions, and so I didn't prepare any thoughts at all. And now that I hear the idea of expressing core beliefs, my core beliefs, the first thing that occurs to me is that I probably don't have any core beliefs. If what one means by core beliefs, some sort of absolute structure, conceptual idea that such and such is so, that is core to me. The Buddhist tradition has a philosophy of corelessness, which is the description of the absolute, you could say. And maybe the mic, it went off. Oh, there it is. And for example, I could ask anyone here, do you believe that Broadway is out there? I think everyone in the room does believe that Broadway is still there. We came in here on Broadway, and I think we all believe it's there. Would any of you describe that as a core belief, sort of an absolute life and death sort of thing, in other words? And I don't think you would, actually, although, of course, it is a belief. It's a, you know, we have lots and lots of beliefs. But the concept of a core belief, like something that is more like that is at the core of your being, I think probably Buddhism educates you to overcome them, actually. I believe the Buddha thought, one of his discoveries was that holding a belief like that, holding something that like is outside of you, that is a concept about something that you have, or a feeling that you have, that you may be only inchoately guided by concept, is a kind of disease, actually. It leads to fanaticism, absolutism, it leads to putting ideas above life itself, actually. And that's how people do throw life into the, sacrifice life itself on the altar of beliefs, actually, and have done so through history. And today is a tremendous danger in the world. They seem to be ready to do so to all kinds of extreme degrees with weapons of mass destruction. So that's why we're all nervous all the time and why we're electing a bunch of morons to run our country. Now, so therefore, I want to like say that in a way, core belief is not really a good question for me. But then, you know, people, of course, probably want to know, like, how did a nice young WASP boy growing up in New York City get interested in Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism? Like, what happened, you know? What did they do wrong at St. Bernard's, Exeter, and Harvard that this guy went astray instead of joining the CIA or getting in the State Department or going to Wall Street or the law school, whatever? How did he get into Buddhism? And so I should tell you that a little bit, although 5 minutes is difficult, but I will finish very shortly because it's too boring otherwise. And really, you might be surprised. I got too interested in Buddhism because I was dissatisfied with the courses that I took in Western philosophy and theology and psychology. I mean, I enjoyed them all. I thought they were good. I didn't, of course, study everything. I missed a lot of things. But I wasn't satisfied. I thought that something was missing. Something was not in them. I certainly was not looking for a core belief. I was handed a bunch of core beliefs and ordered to believe in them, and I rejected them, actually. I never thought that you should believe something that doesn't make sense. And particularly when they tell you that it's not supposed to make sense, and you can't make sense out of it, but you still have to believe in it anyway. I'm sorry if there are those of you who think that blind faith is a good thing and that faith is something beyond reason, But I think actually blind faith is a disease. It's a disaster. It's a part of the structure of the authoritarian personality. Once you have blind faith in something that for no good reason, you could actually have blind faith in anything because you wouldn't have equally any good reason for it. And therefore, people who brought up in a culture of blind faith can end up believing in people like Hitler, George Bush, Ronald Reagan, other kinds of people like that, and think that they're going to save them, those people, and depend on such people. And I think, therefore, it's very misguided and unfortunate thing to do. So I rejected that. But I love philosophy, and I didn't meet Philip Kitcher in those days. I would have stayed in the West, you know, a good secular philosopher. But I met other people, and I really liked it. I especially liked the later Wittgenstein. I liked Nietzsche. But somehow, they didn't seem to me ultimately to have it together. So I was looking and looking, and then I felt, well, maybe yoga was something. I sensed there was something in India. I don't know what. And therefore, as a senior at Harvard, I went to the registrar and took an infinite leave of absence. I didn't realize I was taking an infinite leave of absence. I thought I was taking an indefinite one, which is the bureaucratic term, but I somehow left out the DE. When I came back 6 years later, they told me that I had left out the DE, and they said, ha ha, you guys think you always know everything as undergraduates, and you thought you were going to take an infinite one, but here you are, you're back. Then I asked him, how did he know I didn't have an infinite time in between? But he didn't go for that. I then met lots of gurus, I met swamis, I met roshis, I met sheikhs in the Middle East, you know, Darvish and so forth. I met Christian monks, Orthodox monks in Greece on Mount Athos, places like that. But I didn't really, they all just wanted you just to believe in them, bow to them, like follow their way for no particular reason. So I didn't. When I met the Tibetans, and they represented to me the ancient Indian tradition of Buddhism as translated into their languages, I was just really so happy. And maybe it might shock you, but the real reason, they have a rational alphabet. You don't even laugh because you don't realize how irrational the English alphabet is. A, B, C, D. Did you ever think about it? What is A? Do you think A is what you make when you see an A written on a page? No, you go, ah. B is a labial combined with the vowel I. C is ka. And anyway, what's the difference between a vowel and a consonant? Do you know? Do you think you can speak a consonant? Does it have a sound? No. What do you think B really is? B is... That's it. Nothing happens except your mouth holds a certain position. You have to add a vowel to it, and then suddenly there's a sound. And whereas the Tibetan alphabet and the Sanskrit alphabet are linguistically rational. Kaka ga nga. When I discovered what the Tibetans call kaka, and don't go Freudian on me, when I discovered kaka ga nga, I felt I had come home. A rational alphabet. Cha 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 nya, ta ta da na. The palatals, the sibilants, the dentals, the labials. All together, the gutturals, all located together, the consonants put in one category, borrowing a vowel in order to pronounce them, the vowels in another category, you know, I mean, it was wonderful. And I'd been living all my life in the insane world of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. It was a total homecoming, it was a relief, absolutely. So anyway, I found that therefore more encouragement for reasonable good sense. And so in a way then, I would say my relative belief since then, which in a way was reinforced, that things do make some sort of good sense, that the human intelligence is capable of understanding the world, that there's perhaps no limit to that understanding, and the human intelligence can merge in divine intelligences. I don't believe one particular boss divinity, but that there could be divinities, of course. And that life, if it were to be made sense, could be happy for people. Beings could be happy. There's no need for all this strife and scarcity and violence. It's based on ignorance and delusion and unreason and fanatical wrong beliefs. So those were what I discovered in what I would really call the educational, really, rather than the religious tradition of Buddhism, the psychological, philosophical, and educational tradition. I discovered a curriculum that extended what I had been looking for in our curriculum and made it more total and complete, and tried to educate the whole human being, not just the brain to be clever, to be able to speak well and to know some information and then go out and make a lot of money. I'm afraid a little bit the way our education has been perverted, but also tries to train the heart and also tries to train even the body, even the emotions. And I haven't completed that training, and I hope probably won't in this life, but I just feel it's the right direction, and it fits very well with our curriculum in a way, so therefore I was very much at home returning eventually to America and being a teacher, a poor professor, as they call us.
Okay.
A poor professor. So that's my 5 minutes. Probably a little longer.
We'll let you pick that up later.
Okay, thank you.
Our second panelist is Professor Philip Kitcher, who is a philosopher of science, chair of the Contemporary Civilization Program here at Columbia. Is that right? Do I understand that right? And most of all, he had the good sense to do his doctorate at Princeton University. Professor Kitcher, would you tell us about your core beliefs, and maybe I'll ask you, as Professor Thurman did, to explain a little bit how you came to your core beliefs.
Thank you very much. Good evening. It turns out that I have a lot in common with Bob Thurman, so maybe I'm misrepresented here, or maybe he's misrepresented here. Anyway, I'm here under the banner of secular humanism, and that comes in two bits. There's a secular bit, and there's a humanistic bit. And I thought I might say something about each of them separately. Start off with the secular part. Now, we secularists actually agree with the usual first statement of most other religions, which is that all the other religions are false. And we just sort of generalize that. That doesn't necessarily mean that there couldn't possibly be something out there transcendent beyond the physical world. No, it's possible, we think, that science will continue to disclose things about the world, and one day perhaps we might even have evidence for thinking that there is something of the sort towards which various religions have gestured. But we have no basis at the moment for thinking that. And like Bob Thurman, we believe in using our good sense and our evidence. We are fairly confident that the religions of the world that have been formulated so far don't have it right. And here's why. First of all, the world we live in just doesn't conform to the kinds of substantive doctrines that they claim to make about it. Secondly, they contain vast numbers of internal inconsistencies and difficulties. What we know about the conditions under which their texts were put together tend to undermine the authority of those texts. And most of all, there's the simple, undeniable fact that the persistence of various religions is a matter of tradition and conformity. There are many of you here in the audience, I'm sure, who are devout Christians, and who, if you had been brought up in northern Canada, would have believed what the local people believed, or if you'd been brought up among the newer, would have believed what the local people believed, and so on and so forth. I don't think any of these religions has a claim in its doctrines about spirits or ancestors or divinities on the truth. That doesn't mean that they don't get at things that are important, and that brings me towards the second part of what I want to say about the humanist dimension of my view. It seems to me that all of these doctrines point in their various ways towards significant moral concepts, and many of them towards significant and profound moral truths. The advantage of being a secular humanist is that you don't have to decide that one of these traditions has got all the answers and that the rest are completely beside the point. We can pick freely. We can engage in a full, open moral endeavor to spread various humane values. What do I mean by humane values? I mean things like justice and fairness and kindness and liberal thinking and tolerance, freedom, and above all, a kind of honesty and generosity that I think is currently rather in short supply around the world. So secular humanism is a position that takes humanity and humane values very seriously. And it supposes that those values have been articulated at various points in our history by people as diverse as Jesus and Socrates, the Buddha, and many, many of the authors whom students here at Columbia study. There are important truths about justice and honesty and openness that we need to appreciate, that we need to make practical in action. Now, I'm not sure if I have any core beliefs. I'm not sure I know what a core belief is, but there are certain ideas and values which, as a humanist, guide my life. And those are dedicated towards the thought of doing what I can, either in my academic work or in my life, towards spreading these things as far and as wide as I can. That's what humanism is all about. It refuses to let this process of spreading and discovery be bound by any dogma. It's right there with Bob on that one. We don't like fanaticism, and we don't like the various ways in which moral thinking is held captive to dubious interpretations of texts that have been formulated under conditions of extreme, or more or less extreme, I should say, ignorance in a distant past. We don't want to let people's ability to do research on stem cells be hung up because some of our number claim that, you know, these little collections of cells are somehow sacred, so that they cannot be used, they cannot be employed to spare suffering. We don't believe that people's rights can be abrogated because they have the wrong kind of look, the wrong color skin, because they happen to have the wrong number or the wrong type of chromosomes, or because they have the wrong sort of sexual preference. We believe in liberating our moral thinking from dead dogma and in trying to move forward and to make the world, as Bob said, a happier place. I'm not sure in the end if I buy the stuff about the alphabet or the consultation of the gurus, but that all seems to me pretty benign in contrast with most of what religious perspectives offer. In the end, though, I think I'd rather free our moral investigations from all of it and go forward and try, as a species, as a group, to do the best we can for humanity. Thank you.
Dr. Finney Kuravula is a resident at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. He has a master's and a PhD from Harvard, as well as an MA from MIT. A lot of initials there. He is also the editor of a book published in 2003 called True Christianity, which, as I understand, is a compilation of the writings of 19th century revivalist and social reformer Charles Grandison Finney.
So there have been a wide variety of attempts through the years to try to summarize what the core doctrines are of Christianity, and although they certainly differ in details, I think there are a few elements that are common amongst all of those formulations. The first is obviously the idea that there is a God, a personal God, who has created the universe. The second would be something along the lines of the fact that we as humans have been made in God's image, and despite the fact that we were made in God's image, have decided to reject God, have decided to go our own path, and in so doing, construct our own systems. The third would be, despite that rejection, God has decided to yet love us and still show us mercy and love and compassion, and has communicated to us through the ages by a wide variety of means, culminating in the person of Jesus, who, according to Christianity, was the one who came to show us what the real human being should be like, to be the second Adam, and finally to die for our sins. And then the fourth is that by receiving what God has done for us through the person of Christ, we are able to enter into a right relationship with him and each other. I would agree with Professor Thurman in particular that blind faith is not something that we should relish or embrace. Just to give a little bit of my own story, when I was a freshman in college, I can remember having lots of long discussions late in my dorm room with people of other religions. Being an Indian myself, I've had the privilege of having lots of friends who are Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Christians, and atheists. And what struck me more than anything was that most people, one, didn't really know very much of their own faith too well, certainly not in college, and two, definitely didn't know what the beliefs of other people were. And in fact, in general, I felt like we're more addressing caricatures. And that really bothered me. It bothered me that I couldn't find a person who, say, was a Muslim, but could tell me what a little bit about the New Testament was about, or vice versa. People, maybe who was a Christian, who could tell you about the Quran and why they chose not to be a Muslim. And I ended up doing a long journey and study of an entire field that, to me, convinced me that Christianity was unique in the sense that I believe it is the only religion that begins to make claims that can at least be tested in some way. Granted, not in the same way that we can test a scientific experiment. I'm a scientist. It's using a completely different methodology, but I believe it offers strong evidence for its support. And I began to see that very clearly through history, through a wide variety of means, and then more importantly, I think I began to see it manifest in my own life. I was certainly wrestling with a lot of things, morally, spiritually, that, to be honest, were hard, and I did not find a satisfactory explanation for those, and views that we were particles or illusory or anything other than something created by God. And I believe that our profound desire for the moral, for the just, is in fact planted in us by God. And it was really the confluence of a variety of elements that led me to become a Christian and solidified me in that belief, and I haven't looked back since.
I have a couple of questions just to get the discussion going, and please feel to interact with one another and to engage one another. One of the issues facing all religions, one of the issues that, if you'll pardon the term, bedevils all religions or all systems of belief, is the problem of evil. And we've seen in recent weeks the natural disaster of the tsunami in the Indian Ocean and Indonesia and so forth. How do you explain this from your own perspectives? What sort of grounding or what sort of beliefs or convictions help you to understand what's going on and how to respond to a disaster like this? Professor Kitcher, let's shuffle things up a little bit rather than going in order.
Okay, well, there's one sort of explanation you can clearly give for what happened in the tsunami. There was an earthquake, and it caused a very big wave, and that caused a very large amount of human misery and suffering. And as a matter of fact, not only human history, but the prehistory of human life on Earth has probably witnessed many, many, many such catastrophes. That's not to minimize the loss for the people who suffered in this one. It's just to point to a rather obvious fact about our universe. It's not a particularly hospitable place. It doesn't wear a face of kindness towards our species or towards other species. It's not the sort of universe that you would expect a providential and powerful deity to design. And that is, of course, the source of the traditional problem of evil. I mean, even built into the rules, there seems to be a massive amount of cruelty. As various people have pointed out, it's not just the really nasty cases of, you know, parasitic wasps paralyzing organisms and then eating them up from, having their offspring eat them up from the inside, which troubled religious people in the 19th century. It's also the mere fact that natural selection works in such a way that if the cheetahs get better at pursuing the antelope suffer, and if the antelopes get better at running away from the cheetahs, then the cheetahs starve. There's a kind of cruel logic that's built into it. And so, from a secular humanist perspective, you can give causal explanations of these things, but you can't look for any meaning. And I want to say that it seems to me that the ways in which various providentialist religions sometimes come to terms with this seem to me, at best, implausible, and at worst, obscene. You can't minimize the suffering of these poor people, not only the ones who died, but those who are left behind. Their suffering cannot be seen as some sort of minor detail in an otherwise glorious creation. They are people who have lost enormous amounts. And you can't turn around and say, oh, well, it's all, you know, for the greater harmony of the universe. If that's the attitude that you take, then I want to say there's something morally missing there, something important morally missing. There's a problem of justice there. These people have had to suffer terribly. They've had to suffer in what, from my perspective, is the only life they had. That's a terrible thing. And I don't think that you can rationalize that away and point to a providence beyond.
Okay. Finney, do you want to take it?
Sure. It's, you know, of course, our gut reaction to the tsunami, like Professor Kitcher articulated, is of course one of terrible grief and sadness and a desire for to reach out and to have compassion on those who have gone through such sufferings. I'd like to say a couple things that help me thinking about this problem. Martin Luther King used to say this a lot to the people whom he was leading in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. King was, of course, a Baptist preacher. And he used to say things like, the universe was ultimately on the side of justice. And even though many of you will be beaten, suffer, even die, you have to keep in mind that there's something far larger going on in this. Now, at one level, we think, yes, it is a terrible tragedy that a person has lost his life. However, I think if we view it from a local perspective, I would agree. However, if we can perhaps view it from a broader perspective, perhaps there is something going on that we don't know about that might lead to a vindication or ultimate justice, even for the people who have lost their lives. It's a very difficult question, I fully grant, and I do not want to offer easy answers to this. The problem of evil is something that has certainly plagued all theists from the beginning of time. I mean, you can go back to Plato and read interesting discussions of this. However, we also have to remember that many virtues do come out of evil. Virtues like patience, courage, forgiveness, reconciliation, they're all predicated on evil, right? We cannot have these things in any kind of vacuum in a world of paradise and chocolate bars and all good things where we essentially have a God who just is basically a cosmic vending machine. Instead, I think we have a very different situation that is not nice and it's not pretty, I fully grant. However, in the midst of this pain, I think we should be humble and say, there is mystery to it. Certainly the ending of the book of Job, there's a great verse in Deuteronomy 29. It's Hanis Torot Ladonai Eloheinu, which means the secret things belong to the Lord our God. This idea that there is mystery, there is suffering and there is mystery, and we can't fully understand all these things on this timescale. And I think as human beings, we have to be content with that. I would also say this, that to the extent that you believe the tsunami was just particles of an ocean hitting particles of a human on a beach somewhere, and feel outrage, feel a real sense of injustice, I would argue that's actually pushing you more and more towards some kind of theistic worldview, something where there is something out there that's more than just the laws of physics interacting in some way. That desire, that tremendous outrage we have actually pulls us and should pull us to some kind of notion of something out there, and I believe it is God.
Bob?
Yes. I think maybe I can respond to this by telling a story from the Buddhist literature that I enjoy telling, actually. I have to confess, but I'll try to keep it brief. And it is about when the Buddha, before he became a Buddha, well, there are several versions of it. In some versions, it was a different monk, but in some versions, it was the Buddha himself in a previous existence. He was at that time a great sage and a great meditator and had the ability to sort of travel in a subtle mind-body setting. And at that time, in Buddha's time in India, there was a very strong belief in a creator god, and his name was Brahma. And the Buddha went to Brahma, actually. He went to meet God. You know, Muhammad met God, Jesus met God. People can meet God, apparently, now and then. And he went to meet God, who in that culture was called Brahma. And the reason he went, it was at that time he wasn't yet a Buddha. In other words, understanding the nature of life, which is what a Buddha has claimed to be. But he was trying to get to be one. So he thought he would take a shortcut, and since there was someone who supposedly had created the universe, that person should know how it worked, and if asked, should reveal that to the Buddha. So the Buddha before becoming a Buddha. So he went to the heaven, and there are some funny details to the story about how Brahma wouldn't answer him right away and all many things. But I'll skip that because this is a debate context or a dialogue context. In any case, eventually Brahma said to him, I don't know how the world works because, truth to tell, I did not create it. And he's reluctant to say it to the Buddha in heaven because the angels there think he did, and he doesn't want to freak them out. So first, when he meets the Buddha in the company of all those different, like, angels, the demigods, he sort of says, oh, I'm not going to answer your question, I'm too busy, and all this kind of thing. So then he says, well, I can't disappoint a truth seeker, so I'll tell you that I didn't create it and I don't know, but I can tell that in the future you're going to become a Buddha and you're going to know how the world works, the causality of the world, and at that time you'll know, and I want you to do two things. Come and tell me first. And second, go tell those human beings that when things go horribly wrong for them, when they lose their children, when they lose their own life, when they become sick, when it's a disaster that befalls them, tell them that it's not my fault. I wish the best for all beings. I'm a very jolly, happy Brahma, you know. I'm like God, very powerful, live in a beautiful heaven. And I don't wish any ill to anyone, but I don't control everything. And so that was that story. Buddha lived to tell that tale in a theistic culture 2,500 years ago, which I think in many theistic cultures today, you would be in severe trouble telling that story. A story like that, like somebody went to see Yahweh and Yahweh said, well, really, I'm not all I'm cracked up to be and I don't really know how it works. And really go tell people don't place their fanatical dependence upon me because there's nothing I can really do for them, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how that would go down in quite a few places on this planet today, even in this country. But I enjoy telling it anyway. I like to tell it in the Midwest. I love to tell it in the Midwest. And when I tell it, I always feel in the audience there's a kind of what my colleague Tai Uno at Smith College, a professor of Buddhism there from Japan, used to say, when you tell something a little irreverent like that, at the time you do, there's like this pause for lightning and thunder. And when it doesn't happen, then there's a little bit of relief in the room. So, you know, people were calling me from the media after the tsunami and saying, well, how do Buddhists interpret this, and what's the meaning of it, and all this. And I do associate myself with what Professor Kitcher said, that, you know, why should there be a meaning, in a way? The meaning is, one of the meanings is, that the scientific community wasn't properly funded to install a warning system in the Indian Ocean the way they have in the North Pacific, and therefore the people couldn't get a one-hour warning to get up on a hillside and be saved their lives by the hundreds of thousands. That's one meaning, inadequate funding. Al Gore proposed a program that would have done that, actually, worldwide, and it was vetoed by the Republican Congress. That's one meaning. And another, and one other point I'd like to point out. Oh, good. One other thing I'd like to point out is that when he was vice president, he did that. One that I would like to point out is that my friend Rabbi Michael Lerner says this, and I think this is wonderful. Every day, I believe, 24 million children and other, you know, people of other ages die of malnutrition and malnutrition-related diseases every single day on this planet. And where's the media fuss? This tsunami took actually more like 300,000, I think, when they counted up in Sumatra. But I was actually in Thailand. But every day, 5 million die of preventable diseases. We have stored food here that rots. Like, what is that? And why isn't there any fuss about it, an outcry, and why isn't somebody doing something about it? You know, I mean, that's a meaning of where it is just our callousness, our shutting off, our own selfishness. And that's the meaning of that. That's a meaning that I think is very, very important. And we should use occasions where our awareness is brought up on the misery of people in defenseless situations in this world, who are out of poverty and out of whatever political chaos. We should use the one where we are suddenly brought our attention to, the media allows it to come into our consciousness, by bringing these other things into our consciousness and trying to do something about it. What I think.
Let me recast the question a little bit. It's one thing to, just brief for brief responses, it's one thing to talk about natural disaster, but how does your belief system help you to explain the violence that humans do to other human beings? I'm thinking of mass murder or Charles Manson or somebody like that. How does your belief system, your core beliefs, to use a phrase that we used earlier, whether or not that's valid, help you to understand or to explain actions like that? Finney, you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Yeah, I think from the Christian perspective, it's quite easy. It's been said that the doctrine of the fall is one of the most hated but the most empirically verifiable teaching in the history of the world. Nobody likes to think about the idea that we are fallen creatures. Nobody likes the idea that there's something in us that's wrong, that's sinful, that's twisted and bent out of shape. However, we see it all over the place. We see it, of course, outside, but I think more to the point, and something that I feel a lot more strongly about, is that if we're honest, we actually see it in ourselves. The reality is that when we see some sort of horrific act happen committed by somebody else, we have to ask ourselves, if I were put in their situation, if I were raised in the same conditions that they were raised, maybe that would have been me. Who are we to say and to cast evil as such this outward thing? One of the things that I really appreciate in Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is how strongly he moves the locus of evil from outside into these actions, into the human heart. And again, I really believe that is such an empirically verifiable teaching if you just look inside yourself. I mean, Jesus uses examples like, you're guilty of murder if you're calling your brother angry. You're guilty of adultery if you look at a woman lustfully. And at one level, that sounds crazy. That sounds absolutely mad. However, if all of the restraints, all of our desire for a good life, for not being thrown into prison, for whatever boundaries we might have put around us, if those were fallen away, would it be the case that we might not be that person? So I think the answer is clear, and I think the answer is right inside of us. It's the fall.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to suggest that human beings are wonderful, but the idea that this comes, that we've got some sort of evidence that this comes from a fall, strikes me as a very odd one. Now, it also strikes me as rather odd to say some of the things that you've already said. I mean, this idea of natural disasters or human violence as being an inevitable constituent of a world which somehow reaches some higher good. Take the broader perspective, you said. I mean, I imagine a God trying to create a good world, a very powerful God, not Bob's sort of rather, limited character, but, a really powerful one. I guess, it doesn't seem to me that this God would play with certain individuals as pawns and say, well, I've got to have a bit of courage in my world, so, some people are going to have to be under conditions of hardship. They're going to have to suffer a bit. All right. Well, it could be you, you, and you. And I think a God who acts like that is not the epitome of justice. And I don't think a God who produces creatures with the amount of violence and inhumanity that we see in some of the worst doings of history can be completely let off the hook. I mean, if you turn Bob's story around and you imagine a really, omnipotent, benevolent, providential God, he can't just say, well, it's not my fault, I can't control the situation. He must assume responsibility for this. And that's why I guess it seems to me that this whole idea of, a creation story that proceeds this way is just a myth. We do better to face the fact, it's not that we're fallen creatures, but we're creatures who have some potential for doing good things and for doing bad things. And our task is to work to get beyond the selfishness to which Bob rightly pointed a moment or two ago. I mean, millions of children die every year of preventable diseases. It's a huge number, and we do nothing about it. Occasionally, our president makes a promise, and then he forgets about it or imposes conditions that the recipients can't meet. This is morally obnoxious. And we should take a stand against any president who speaks in the name of Christianity and refuses to do the things in our world that could make the lives of millions of people much better. I wish that the man in the White House spent less time reading various bits of the New Testament than he does and concentrated much more on the Sermon on the Mount, which you quoted a moment or two ago. Because within that sermon, as in many other pieces of literature from many other traditions, are important moral truths about kindness and social justice. And we could use a bit of that.
The Buddhists have an idea. We have a view of evolution that is very similar to the scientific one, the secular humanist one. But in a way, it also bridges a little toward the theistic or religious one, in that it does not see the human being's life as a single one, emerging from matter at some stage of birth or conception or growth of the brain, and then disappearing back into oblivion, so to speak, with the death of the brain. We do see it as actually, but not as a sort of core belief, but as a relatively better description of life, that all energy in the world has continuity, and therefore nothing can come out of nothing, and never could have. And such a statement that something came from nothing is an incoherent statement from the Buddhist philosophical point of view, and that something could become nothing is also incoherent, because nothing is nothing that you can become. And therefore, there's always continuity. So the doctrine of evolution is even more, the human being is more embedded in evolution than in the materialist form, which does embed a human being in a sort of, in the life form, you know, morphology of life forms, you know, as something coming out of natural selection and so forth. In the sense that the human consciousness as a subtle type of energy, not necessarily as non-material, you know, as something completely irrationally proposed as non-material but yet relating to matter, yet radically opposite from matter, but as something of a subtle material nature, let's say, but that there is a continuity of that. And therefore, death, the habits that people have, the things that the acts that they do continue, the consequences of those acts do follow beings from life to life. And a person in a particular life who suffers tremendous violence can be guaranteed by the theory of karmic evolution, as I would call it, that they dished it out themselves in a previous life. And therefore, they can use it in that life, even if they die, to sort of avoid such a thing in the future life and not to do it to other beings in a future life. So the theory of karmic evolution, in a way, is a little like a middle way between the theodicy thing that the theists do, where they try to say that, well, it's all some unfathomable mystery and it's all going to work out well in the end, especially for those who believe in the right religion. So rather unpleasantly, those who do not believe in that religion, there are theories, I believe, in fundamentalist America that the tsunami mostly claimed, of course, infidels, and it's one of the signs of the coming rapture, and it's the destruction of a bunch of non-Christians, and they're all going to hell anyway after the final judgment, which is coming soon. And that sort of thing, I think, is a bit unpleasant, actually, I have to say. And we don't have any such condemnation of other beings, say, beings who are not Buddhist or whatever. Evil arises from ignorance. People harm others and actually harm themselves because of lack of knowledge of the consequences of what they do. For example, they kill a person because they think that by killing them, they're removing them from their universe. But from the Buddhist point of view, it's very dumb to kill somebody, because when you kill them, they get reborn and they come back at you in another life, mad as hell. And they might be born as your child or your relative or someone who you wouldn't suspect. And therefore, in the Buddhist civilizations, they stopped sort of their idea of the, you know, which people do when they have wars, they make the enemy in the war some sort of subhuman, you know, so they can kill them with impunity right when they train their troops. You know, the gooks or the Bosch or the whatever they call them. The Yankees, I think, we're pretty disliked by the rest of the planet right now. And they think they're sort of getting rid of them, but in the Buddhist worldview is that the individual, if you're fighting the Russians or the Germans or the Arabs or the, whoever is your enemy, then you die in that battle, you're likely to be reborn among them. And you may be the rebirth of a Russian or whoever the archenemy is, you know, the archfiend. So it did erode, actually, the war-making ideological capacity of those societies throughout history in Asia. And actually, there was a relatively less war. Therefore, they were vulnerable to the European conquest 400 or 500 years ago. You know, first the Muslim and then the European conquest. So it's a little bit of a middle way, you know, to talk about violence. There, Max Weber, the sociologist, who of course didn't believe in it, but he did say that the karmic theory, the karmic evolutionary, he didn't call it evolutionary, but the karmic theory of causality is the neatest moral accounting system humanity has ever devised. He did make that statement. But he didn't, that didn't mean he believed in it, he just thought it was neat. Indians have a tendency to come up with neat accounting systems, actually, even from ancient time.
Okay.
So that's a little bit of a middle way to just confuse the issues. Okay, Brent.
Soon we're going to open up the mics for questions from the audience, but let me proceed with a couple more. As a secular humanist or a Buddhist or a Christian, how do you provide hope and comfort to someone who is grieving at a time of loss or death? Bob?
Well, maybe I'll start with that because that fits with what I was just saying. A few years ago, it took me years in dealing with Buddhist thought to sort of to see this in a way, like empirically in a certain way. And it happened when I was commissioned to retranslate and do a study of the Tibetan so-called Book of the Dead, which is not called the Book of the Dead in Tibetan. It's called the Book of Natural Liberation Through Learning in the After-Death State, is the actual title of the book. Because apparently just after you die, your subtle mind-body complex is in an out-of-body condition, sort of circling around where you used to live, and actually in a state of great bewilderment, because it can't get back into your body and wake up. You can't get back into your body. It's sort of like the movie, if you ever saw the movie Ghosts, the guy who wrote that movie, Rubin, he had read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, actually, and he was inspired by that. And that thing where, I forgot the name of the actor, you know, he meets, only Whoopi Goldberg can see the ghost, you know. And that's all from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But he actually dramatized it in that movie. And what is the insight or the eureka experience I got from that is, eureka, there are no such things as dead people. You know, people think of somebody as dead, you know, so-and-so is dead, and they wonder where they are. Then is there a ghost coming? You know, they're like, there's even TV programs like that. But in the Buddhist worldview, there are no dead people. And in the cultures where that is a really dominant worldview, like Tibet, the most dominant place, they actually have given up ancestor worship. Because in China and other parts of Asia, they're very big on ancestor worship because you think of your grandfather as having died. And in those cultures, grandpa is up there someplace. And every once in a while, you go into the family shrine and you give grandpa a cup of tea and a cookie, just in case, you know, he needs tea. But other Buddhist countries still do that because they didn't sort of fully get into the worldview, the evolutionary worldview. But the Tibetans completely quit that. And why is that? Because grandpa's not sitting around being dead. After grandpa dies, gets reborn, and you might be grandpa. You know, you might be grandma, so I'll give you a cookie and a cup of tea instead. You know, we don't have the ability to know and recognize, unless we develop clairvoyance, who's grandpa. So then they get where they diffuse that sort of slightly racist idea about my ancestors as sort of the big thing, and they see everyone as potentially their kin and their ancestors. It's a very nice byproduct of that view. But the key point I'm trying to make is that, therefore, Philip would say earlier that so-and-so, they lost their only life they ever had. And that makes death a great tragedy, of course. Secular humanism does. But in another way, it doesn't make it as much at all as a tragedy as if there's some kind of soul theory. Why? Because at least once they're dead, in the secular humanist view, they don't know they ever lived because they're just in oblivion. They're just gone, period, and that's the end of them, right? And so they're not anymore grieving. The ones behind maybe are grieving, but the people who died, since they don't know they ever did live, they're sort of out of the game. And that's why people with that view will commit suicide a little bit easier. And perhaps some of the Marxists or the really heavy secularist communities, they will kill people by the many millions, thinking that, well, once they're dead. And also, once I'm dead, and there's no consequence to me for all this. Someone like Stalin or Mao, there's no consequence to me for all this killing. In the view where there's some kind of soul thing, but not as a non-material thing, as a subtle material thing, sort of like a virtual mind-body complex. In that sort of view, there's a consequence to everything you do. And if you take a life, you're going to lose a life. And therefore, it's a very serious matter to take a life because you lose again and again. Luckily, there's no eternal damnation in such a thing, but there's an endless cycle in a way. And unless you achieve liberation or Buddhahood, but which you therefore do finally because you get bored with the endless cycle. But this is therefore, however, even the worst tragedy in Holocaust, there's no way to redeem what happened, and there's no way to rationalize and say it's all in somebody's plan. But the people who you're concerned with are the people who died that you, and therefore rituals in Buddhist societies and so forth have to do with the people who died, to see that they go and get a better rebirth. And maybe all those people in around that part of the Indian Ocean and the southern part of the Bay of Bengal would be, you'd pray that they'd be reborn somewhere in the Northwest Pacific so they'd have a better tsunami warning system in their next life, perhaps. Because it's the ongoing people. You don't just sit and mope about, oh, they killed so many of the millions in the past. You're concerned with the ongoing people. That's the key point. And that consoles people, I think, actually.
Well, as you get older, one of the unfortunate things about living is that you get to do this more frequently. And it's difficult. I don't think I can stand next to my friends who have gone through experiences that have caused them great grief. Losing loved ones, in some cases losing children, and say to them, be comforted, because there's this great cycle of regeneration. You know, there's this funny mind stuff. We don't quite know how to define it, but it goes on and on, and it gets conserved. And by a wonderful piece of accounting, if bad things happen to you this time, it's going to be better next time. We have no evidence for that. That seems to me like the blindest of blind faith. And I have to say, on the other side, I can't say what Anglican clergymen in my youth used to tell grieving parents or grieving children. You know, don't worry, you'll be rejoined in the hereafter. We have no evidence for the hereafter. So what can one say? One can help. One can help in the most practical ways. One can help dry the tears. One can be a friend. One can be there for people. And one can bring people who've suffered special kinds of tragedies into the business of trying to work so that those kinds of tragedies won't happen to others. You do what you can, and what you can is very much specific to the situation. There isn't any all-purpose remedy that I can offer. You just have to be there for your friends. You have to grieve with them. You have to comfort them. You have to do all the things that many of the religious and philosophical teachings of the world tell you to do. But you have to listen. You have to comfort their predicament. And insofar as you can, you have to work with them to make sure that others don't suffer in the same way. So this is a very hard question. If death is really the end, as I believe it is, it means that many people in our world live short and miserable lives. We can't do anything for that. We can't promise anything for that. All we can do is try to work so that future generations will do better. And I think there's something important in that, and if we can bring those who have suffered and lost into that endeavor, that may be the best thing we can do for them.
One of the points which I'd first like to address is, I said in the beginning that one of the things that most bothered me in my journey to Christianity was caricatures, and how I felt like caricatures were often put up, scarecrows were put up and then knocked down. And I feel like we have to be very careful not to go down that path, particularly along this discussion. The view was mentioned before of certain people who believe that just being part of a right religion gives you justice, but not if you're outside of that, or a capricious God who sort of gives people these hard tasks and just for the sake of instilling courage in them, views of the tsunami being some sign of an imminent rapture. I do not deny that there are those who hold those views. Right. However, I do maintain that they are all caricatures of what I would call Christianity is. And I think it's really easy to set up these things because they're, to be honest, it's a lot easier. It sounds simpler. You can elicit strong reactions, but I don't think that's right. And I think that I really want to just first say that I don't think that some of the tendencies that I've heard so far are going in the right direction, and that I do again sense this addressing of caricatures. Regarding how to address a person who is suffering after the loss of a loved one, you know, we ought not to begin with a standpoint of what can we tell this person to make them feel better, or what can we make this tell this person to, you know, just tide them over for the next weeks, months, whatever. All of these things that I have said before are predicated on a system that I think was not validated by comforting of human emotions or anything like that. And a lot of people really believe that religion was sort of invented to comfort people, to make them feel better, to sort of tide them over through tough times, to make them be better people. Again, my claim in the beginning was this was not what Christianity was. I think the comfort that we can give to people is that, yes, I strongly do believe that God ultimately gives justice to every single person who has ever walked this planet, without exception. And that is something that some, of course, will deny. And I cannot offer something to you right now that will prove that to you. However, given if you do begin to accept the claims of Christ and the other the other evidences that I think are found in Scripture, I think we begin to see that there is, in fact, a much more satisfying picture that it comes from this, where we can offer genuine comforts, not out of just a desire to please or to placate or to offer some kind of soft soap, but out of a desire to offer a real truth that's grounded in what I believe is Christianity, and I feel like is the true system.
At the risk of sounding like a revival preacher, I'd like to invite the members of the audience to come forward into these microphones. And offer their questions. But before, as you do that, oh my goodness, a quick question for each of you, a really easy one. What is truth?
What is truth?
Truth.
Pontius Pilate.
Didn't he ask that question?
Supposedly in the King James Version.
Jesting Pilate.
What?
What is truth? Asked Jesting Pilate.
Actually, in Buddhism, we have two types of truth, relative truth and absolute truth. And relative truths are really the only ones that are sort of propositional. Absolute truth is an absolute negation. Well, it's a rather complicated doctrine. But one of the great troubles of humanity is that relative truths are made into absolutes. But truth, I guess truth can be, the word truth can be used in reference to a proposition, right, as true or false in a proposition, or truth can mean a reality, the reference of a proposition. And the only ultimate truth in Buddhism is freedom from any relative thing being an ultimate truth.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
that sounds complicated, but it's really very simple.
This is actually something I think about from time to time.
Me too.
And, I mean, if this is going to sound very simple, even simplistic, a truth is correspondence between thought or words and reality. So if I say there's a glass of water on the table, what I do is I pick out a particular kind of thing in the world and a particular place, and what I say is true if the thing I pick out is the kind of thing I say it is and is in the particular place. Now, then it gets complicated because there are many languages for describing our world, and none of those languages are privileged. And when it comes to the most important things that we care about, this kind of simple approach to truth doesn't seem very workable. And so philosophical accounts of truth have to get more complicated to cope with things like moral statements, and philosophers debate whether or not those statements are true. I'm a kind of objectivist about morality. I think that there really are genuine moral principles, principles of justice and so forth. But the truth of those can't be explained in so simple a way. It must rather be understood in terms of what comes to be if we go on the process of free moral inquiry and, as it were, imagine it proceeding as far as possible. I mean, I've talked a bit about justice. Other people have talked about justice this evening. And it's obviously very important to the position that I defend here. I think at the moment we live, as Bob has very amusingly pointed out, in an extremely unjust world. There's no doubting the phenomena of injustice in our world. But our task is to figure out how to make it more just. And we won't know how to talk about true principles of justice until we've done a lot more work and engaged ourselves in a lot more collective activity. So there's a simple way to think about truth for simple kinds of statements, but there have to be more complicated ways of thinking about truth for more complicated statements. And those relate to our action and to the kinds of things we do and the kinds of world we make.
I certainly defer to Professor Kitcher's expertise on defining truth, and I wholeheartedly would agree with the statements that he just made. There's an additional aspect in Christianity which is a bit mystical, and I have to admit, coming from the Western mindset, it's hard for me to understand. It comes from one of Jesus' own statements. John 14:6, I believe. He says, "Ego mi io dos ke aletheia ke izoi." And that word aletheia is usually translated truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus does a really interesting thing in that verse. He actually, again, moves the concept of truth merely from propositions to that of being a person. And the idea of truth being a person, again, I freely admit, sounds mystical, sounds strange. However, I do think offers a lot of explanatory power. C.S. Lewis used to say, "I believe in Christianity as I believe in the sun. Not merely because I see it, but because I see all things by it." And in the view of truth as a person, this person who begins to illuminate not only the propositional arena of truth, but relationships, things that can't be tested by scientific experiments, I think we can begin to appreciate that truth is even more multifaceted, and I would argue is really ultimately bundled up into the person of Christ.
Now, we have a lot of eager questioners. I'm going to ask you to be brief and perspicuous, and we'll go alternately starting here, please.
Great. Just real quickly, a brief comment. As a person with a theological education and who's becoming an ordained pastor, I just wanted to point out that I do not believe in the ideas of original sin or of Jesus dying for our sins. And I know that Jesus may have said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," but Jesus did not say that "I am the only way, the truth, and the life." So I just wanted to point out that Christianity cannot be boxed up into definite definitions that are held by church dogma. And I also wanted to ask you all real quickly, if you think that religion, the role of religion in international affairs is getting a lot of press these days, and I wanted to see if any of you had feelings that it might be being used as a decoy for something much deeper. Thank you.
I couldn't understand what he said. It's an echo, I can't hear.
What was the second part?
Is religion being used as a decoy for something deeper?
In conflict around the world. Thank you.
I guess I just want to say that I wish we could move beyond the clash of religions. I think it's dogged human history. I think it's been a disaster. I think it's brought untold misery to millions of people. I wish we could get beyond it without falling into the trap to which Bob referred of totalitarianism and carelessness about life. I mean, we have to find a way of avoiding all of these fanaticisms. I think I like where Bob began. And I guess it seems to me that many of the problems that are faced in the names of religion today are matters of socioeconomic injustice, that poor people, deprived people, humiliated people will readily follow a movement, a violent movement, even one that has a religious face pinned on it.
Okay, here.
Yeah, I wanted to say too that the reason, I don't know what you mean quite by decoy, I'm sorry I couldn't exactly hear what you said, but I think the reason that religions are becoming very powerful in mobilizing the behaviors of populations again is that secularism has sort of like lost its luster. You know, technology, industrialization was in the whole sort of secularist idea of progress that we would reach a sort of place where all human suffering, you know, medicine would heal things, and people sort of like it ended up in Frankenstein, actually, where Mrs. Shelley saw it going, and they just couldn't solve the problems. And actually, like, modern technological warfare is a greater disaster than ever. The population explosion, I mean, the planet is in really, the pollution of things is in a very dire condition, and so people are reverting to sort of older worldviews. And all of it having to do, I think, with the fundamental problem about absolutizing truth. What I said about the two truths, I think, is a very important thing that people could entertain. And one of them is, meaning that basically there is no absolute truth. If people could kind of get the idea that the truth that they hold is not absolute, they would be more, and was something relative, it was something from their perspective, something that involved their ego. Then they would be not in danger of it becoming so absolute about it that they would develop this kind of intolerance toward others that would become lethal, that we see becoming lethal everywhere. You know, like truth is a person or not a person. I mean, that statement, I mean, you said it a little bit mystical. I'm thankful that you said that, because otherwise it's a completely irrational statement. Its truth is beyond person and imperson. You know, the absolute is beyond relational categories like person or impersonal. And therefore, to cling that that's absolutely that is basically a seed of real trouble. You know, or just as to cling that absolutely not that, I have to dish one back to my good colleague, Professor Kitcher. To believe that after death, the consciousness becomes nothing, there is absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. And that is, therefore, the blindest of blind faith as well, I have to say. No one ever reported that after I died, I went into a sleep from which I never awoke. Therefore, there is no measurement, there is no encounter with it, and no report of it. And there are many reports of people remembering previous lives, of people, many, many. There's a huge wealth of evidence of it.
They all remember being Cleopatra, as I remember.
No, not at all. There's many, like a young girl in like Kerala remembers living as a granny in Tamil Nadu somewhere, in some place she should never have heard of with the level of non-education she got, finally dragging as a teenager her parents over there, and also not getting on the Johnny Carson show or on the like Jay Leno or anything, no royalties, no agent. Dragging those people on a bus ticket that they could ill afford to spend, going into some town, going into some mud
hut, Bob.
Scrabbling in a mud door. Let me finish the story. And digging up 150 rupees she had saved in a cookie jar for the family in that house.
Okay. All
there
right.
are stories like that. Stories laid down. Verified account.
Let's go here, and I've also asked the panelists to kind of keep their answers short as well.
Yeah, I had two questions, one for Robert and one for Finney. Robert, I was wondering if you could talk about the influence that Zoroastrianism, the karmic theology of Zoroastrianism had on Buddhism through the Silk Road and stuff like that. There's little written on it, but the little that's written is very interesting because there is a karmic order in Zoroastrianism as well.
Somehow the echo in here, I really cannot understand what you're saying. It's like you're speaking
Greek. Influence of Zoroastrianism.
Sorry, what?
Influence of Zoroastrianism on theories of the karmic order.
Oh, my. Zoroastrianism is credited with the sort of two gods, good and evil gods, and I don't think it really had that much influence in India. It's rather had quite a lot of influence in Judaism and Christianity, I think. On the sort of figure of the evil one and so forth, you know, the duality, the dualism of Zoroastrianism, that's how it's usually known. But I don't know really much about Zoroastrianism, and as having influence in the karmic theory, I've never heard of that. I don't think that's necessarily, I mean, that may be, but I've never heard of it. I'm sorry, I couldn't follow really what you said. Your mic.
Hello?
There you go.
Hello.
All right. While we get that fixed, let's go here quickly.
Yeah, my question is also for Bob Thurman. Can you hear me?
Can't hear what you said.
It is for you.
Okay. As far as the bowing down to golden statues is concerned, is that something that has to be done, or could I ask, is that something that you do?
Bowing down to
you
golden
down
statues.
To golden statues.
Golden Buddhas. I've been to Buddhist temples.
Asking if bowing down to golden statues is part of what you do.
Bowing to golden statues?
Yeah.
No, I don't bow to golden statues. I bow to wooden statues, plaster statues, mud statues. I bow to the air, the sky. I bow to different things at different times. Actually, bowing is a really good calisthenic. It's actually better than a full prostration, which they do, the Tibetans do, and some of them will go 1,000 miles doing prostrations everywhere, very devotional types. It's really good exercise on the back. It's like a push-up. It's like a sit-up. And it also has, instead of jogging, where you're reinforcing the limbic brain's orientation toward hunting somebody, something or running away from something, generating either fear or aggression, when you bow, you're generating humility, and you're touching the earth, and it's really a good thing. And no people like Hindus and Buddhists and Confucians who make idols, as you might call them, I would gather, from your talking about golden statues, which, by the way, Muslims think Christians do by putting up crucifixes, and they're very, very disapproving of that. But people who do that know very well that the crucifix is not Jesus. that the image of a Buddha is not Buddha, that the image of Confucius is not Confucius. They're simply reminders, like a snapshot of your loved one you might carry in your wallet. And so if there is a principle of enlightenment in the universe, one might bow to that and hope to achieve that. If there was a, you know, just like you would hope, those who are Christians will revere the crucifix because they feel that's a symbol of God becoming human to help human beings. But they're not bowing to a wooden cross or a rather uncomfortable looking figure on the wooden cross. They're not considering that the deity. So idolatry can be taken both ways. The worst idolatry is the conceptual idolatry of thinking that your idea about reality is the absolutely correct one.
Okay, in the interest of time, I think I'm going to rule the follow-ups out of order, just so we can get more folks to the microphone. Would you mind yielding to the next person, please? Thank you. I'm sorry.
Oh, Don? Don? My question is more a la Oprah Winfrey, so bear with me. I just want to know, each one of you is here representing a religion or a belief. I wanted to know, each one of you, how does Buddha do it for you? How does secularism do it for you? How does Jesus do it for you? When you wake up in the morning, what drives you? When you go to sleep, what peaceful thoughts do you get? You know, something like that. What drives you? What motivates you through your beliefs? Or is it just, that's my belief, nothing's to it, it's just me? Or it's just basically, what's your motivation? How does your belief system make you happy or just satisfied with life?
Okay, Finney?
Sure. Let me just say one thing as well in response to that. I didn't get a chance to answer that first question, and I'll touch on yours. My answer is very brief. I think the one thing that, again, I've noticed is it's very popular to take religion and blame it for a lot of the world's problems, to say that once we jettison religion, finally we will reach not a utopia, but we'll be free of many of the problems that have plagued us for a long time. I think it's become almost cool, almost popular to do that, particularly in academic settings, and I find that trend extremely disturbing for several reasons. One is that I feel like it's historically wrong, because many of the benefits which we now reap and enjoy are directly the result of the work of very devout religious people. My own area of interest is in abolition, which those of you who have studied the history was almost exclusively the product of Christians. The civil rights movement, many of you know, was largely the product of people like Martin Luther King, and the Southern Baptist movement in general, which is incredibly maligned today, actually did a lot of good. And I actually think that to the extent that we bite back at religion and blame it for these problems, we have to be very careful to remember that other such experiments have been attempted in the past with disastrous consequences. To answer your question, I think that my answer is the same as what, I don't know if anybody here knows who Johnny Erickson Tada is. She's actually a very famous Christian who's actually quadriplegic through a diving accident. And she said that every day when she wakes up in the morning, she prays something like, God, help me to remember that the decisions I make today will affect my happiness and the happiness of those around me forever. That's an amazing thought, not just on some kind of, you know, whimsical, you know, here today, gone tomorrow thing, but that the decisions that we make in the here and now will actually have eternal consequences. And I find that to be extremely motivating.
Okay. You want to handle this? What gets you up in the morning?
Well, I just
usually the alarm clock.
Yeah, well, spoken but, like a secularist.
Oh, look, I mean, I really like what I do. And what I do is I teach and I write and I spend time with my friends and my family and I do what I can. And for me, it's all a matter of trying, not on an eternal scale, definitely not on an eternal scale, on a local scale, to the extent that I can on a global scale, to help people see things, to teach, to open up people's minds to ideas they would never have thought of, and to serve, to help, to console, to enjoy life with. I mean, these things are what give my life a meaning, and I'm sure that people who are not religious, like me, will have many, many different ways of balancing various of those aspects. But it works. It's enough. You don't have to have something that, you don't have to say from the standpoint of the end of the universe, how will this look? It's enough for me if it looks pretty good for days, months, years, the rest of my lifetime. And if I can do what I can while I'm here to help other people, that seems to me good enough. And that's really the spirit of your quadriplegic, except that she just wants to go a little bit further. She wants to say the significance is eternal.
I'll stop, you know, with maybe, you know, I'm not ambitious, a week or two, a year or two, a century at most, but not eternal.
Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with Finney, and your mystic, the lady, I didn't catch her name because of the echoes I'm having trouble hearing, but I think that idea, that's a karmic idea. The karmic idea is that what you do resonates in consequence forever. Not that there is a sort of static forever, but it resonates in consequence forever, and therefore the moment is of extreme importance. And that motivates me a lot, that everything, you know, that's like the butterfly wings, right, relating to the hurricane, you know, that notion of chaos. I like that. But I must say, I don't really think such grand things also when I get out of bed. I basically, somehow resign myself to not staying in bed, which I would rather do, and I curse myself for being a workaholic, and I rush off to whatever it is I'm going to do, which I do love doing, actually. I was delighted to discover that the type A personality is not really in danger if they're hyperactive, as long as they love what they do. If they have a job that they hate, but they do it just for the salary, they're in deep danger. They're in deep danger for the thing. But you know, when you said about religion, I'd just like to say, Finney, too, that if religion is defined as the spiritual thing that drives people with it, what you might call a belief in love, a trust in humanity, a desire for the best in humanity, and a seeing of others as potentially capable of the best, if that's what you think of as religion and spiritual, then I think all religions have that vein. And that vein, of course, is absolutely necessary. And if every religion could find that vein, there would be no division among them. No one would be trying to convert anybody to anybody else's religion. Everyone would be respecting other people's religion. In fact, it would be considered a human rights violation to try to convert somebody to your religion because theirs is bad. And if we all believed in love in that way, and if spirituality helped us do that, I think that there would be no problem. When people blame religion, it is because of the manipulation of people's gullibility into fanatical absolutism about some form of ego that is wrapped up in a concept of their religion that makes the danger. And that's really on the rise nowadays, and therefore one has to speak up against that, I believe.
Okay, right here.
My question is, I guess in response to several of the original questions, which is, I guess just what is your opinion and your perspective on perfection and the possibility of attaining perfection individually or as a society?
Anybody want to take it?
I'll start. Sure. It's a great question. I think I would, like any other Christian would say that it's to achieve perfection on earth is not possible. I do think that one of the ideas that we can't find in Scripture is this idea of slowly becoming like God, slowly becoming more and more like Christ, not only in this time period, but in after death. And so I would say to that extent, I think that humans can certainly approach perfection, although I would say that only God ultimately has true perfection in the sense of morally and with all of his attributes, power, wisdom, etc.
Okay. Do you want to go on or do you want to address it?
What?
Do you want to go on?
Yeah,
to the next
I think
question?
You can attain perfection of understanding given an infinite number of future lives.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to become a Buddha. Even I think it's too boring otherwise.
I want to thank the panel very much. I do want to make a comment as a young social worker who has seen the extreme power of spirituality work in people's lives. I think it's very important not to trivialize. And I know we're having a great time here and we're laughing. But I do want to point out that I think, and I'm sure no one on the panel intends it, that it's very important not to trivialize traditions or faiths or belief systems that are, you know, whether it's ancestor worship or Christianity or secular humanism, you know, people have been on a journey for a long time to find what's important to them in their lives. But I wanted to ask Bob Thurman directly. We talked a little bit earlier about suffering in the world and how different traditions respond to that. Can you say a little bit about what the Buddhist perspective on suffering is and the idea of not avoiding suffering because it brings more suffering to us?
Buddhist perspective on suffering?
Yes.
Suffering sucks. And suffering is not essential and necessary, and human beings particularly have the opportunity to free themselves from suffering by developing their understanding, not just by faith, but by coming to an understanding of the causes of suffering.
That is the view of Buddhism. The Pope misunderstood Buddhism, thinking that Buddhism says everybody just has to suffer. But he didn't say that. He actually said the unenlightened person is bound to suffer because they're deluded about what the world is like. They're living in a world of delusion, and therefore it's like they don't know there's a wall they're going to walk into because they're deluded. Once they clear away that delusion by developing understanding, then they can free themselves from suffering. That's the Buddhist view. So it is not like that everyone is doomed to suffer. In fact, people should not be doomed to suffer. The earth can be made infinitely better. We don't have to wait for God to do it or some other person to do it. There is no reason why, if we developed our understanding better, we couldn't make this world into something really excellent place. And there I do really love the human, like the great humanist Buckminster Fuller, for example, who was not exactly, he was a little more religious humanist, but he was certainly a scientist and a humanist. And he thought there was no limit to the developability of the planet and the world if people would only use their heads instead of following their baser instincts, so to speak.
Okay. Maya?
So that's the perspective.
My question is predominantly for the Christian perspective. With the sort of smallness of the world and the growing value of tolerance culturally, some have charged that Christianity has been domesticated, in a sense, that it's been declawed. There's no more talk of fire and brimstone in the churches. It's much more feel good. How would you respond to that kind of charge? And if you feel that that's the case, how would you reconcile an inconsistent faith with the notion of a consistent God?
Can you explain that last part, an inconsistent faith?
If the evolution of, you know, the articulation of Christianity has changed and you believe for the better, how would you reconcile that with the notion of a consistent religious dogma or a consistent deity?
Right. I mean, I certainly would agree with you that Christianity has been, as you put it, domesticated, and that a lot of the, some people would argue that Christianity, in some circles, has become merely a social justice club, and that there is very little thinking of eternity and souls and these kinds of issues. So yeah, I mean, I think that's true. However, my perspective is that is a turn for the worse. Not that social justice is bad; it's part of the whole puzzle, but that we ought not to ride the latest crest of whatever religious movement might happen to be afoot in Christianity, which you have highlighted very well.
Can I ask you a direct question about this? I mean, do you actually believe that the just God is going to sentence some of us, certainly me, to a very long time in a very nasty place?
Yeah. So my answer to that is as follows. There, C.S. Lewis put it best. He says, there are two kinds of people in the world. There is one type of person who says to God, thy will be done. And there's another class of person to whom God says, thy will be done. And I absolutely believe that one of the most wrong beliefs about hell that we have is that it is a place where people are sort of trying to get out, clambering out. You know, there's cages, and God kind of slams the door down, stomps his foot, and starts laughing at that. It's not that at all. Tim Keller, who's actually a pastor here at Redeemer Presbyterian, says that hell is the greatest monument to human freedom ever, in the sense that whatever hell is, it is certainly not anything but a person's own choice. And I believe that's absolutely fundamental to that. People who reject God on earth, I think we'll continue to reject him. And this idea that there is anything but a...
it's not rejecting, it's just not believing in. That's different, you know. It's not as though he sort of comes up and says, hey, here I am, accept me. And we say, well, no, actually I reject you. It's more just not believing. Look, I mean, I guess I want more clarification on this. The New Testament is full of passages that say that people who don't believe and many who claim to believe will be eternally punished. I mean, you just think those shouldn't be taken seriously. Is that
no, right? I absolutely think they should be taken seriously. And I think that they are part of what I was just referring to, that this eternal punishment fundamentally is the result of the human choice, that the person who does not want God will not get God.
So for a few finite actions, I get eternal punishment, and it's so, real punishment?
So that's one of the mistakes that I was trying to address, is that it's not a finite amount of sin leads to an infinite amount of punishment. It's that a person continues to choose this on into eternity, so to speak. So it's infinite matches infinite, not
so
finite to infinite.
So if after the event, you know, when confronted with the reality of this, you change your mind, then you're saved? Is that the idea?
I mean, certainly, I would say that's theoretically possible. I believe that, that once a person has made that choice, I don't think that they would.
Okay, I'm terribly sorry. We'll take one more question, and I apologize.
Well, where is the omnipotent God?
Exactly.
Creates a being.
Dante says love is written over the gates of hell. This is love?
If it's an insult to God to say that God would do that if he was omnipotent. It's an insult. It says the person is that person is a sadist.
Yes.
They create a being that then resists them and then is punished eternally.
Again,
it's like an eternal S&M factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the point of that belief?
Right.
What is the point of that belief? How can you rationalize that belief along with the idea of a compassionate God?
Right.
So that's
again,
insane.
I freely admit to those who are on the outside, the belief can appear strangely unsane, sick, twisted, whatever adjective you want to use. You can probably pile on a lot more. However, I do think that once a person really understands what sin is and what it is to go against God, and this is something that, to be honest, in my experience, few people who are not in Christianity can really understand. I certainly feel like this, that I would be the first one to join God in condemning myself for the things that I've done. And that's a hard realization for many people who are on the outside to understand, because I believe it's a low notion of God. It's a low notion of God who tolerates injustice. And who tolerates...
If you believed in Jesus and God as being compassionate, then you would know that Jesus himself would go to hell with all those people and stay there until they were let out.
Well, but I would argue that's exactly
and
what he did.
And any notion that you can write off a bunch of people because they're going to always resist and they're going to be eternally damned, ha ha, that's cute, I'm happy because I believe, that leads to a terrible division within humanity. It leads to this terrible idea that... I had a friend, a colleague who was a professor of Buddhist studies in Harvard, a Japanese man who had unfortunately been part of the civil defense group that had to clean up Nagasaki after the atomic bomb was dropped on them. And he was distressed by some missionary who was screaming that now finally those Japanese in Nagasaki had gotten what they deserved because of their heathen beliefs and so forth, and screaming and shouting this guy. Of course, the guy was probably deranged because being around like a nuclear mess like that is enough to derange anybody. But still, this leads to this kind of belief where you can sort of comfortably, with a little smile on your face, talk about how people will be eternally punished by this all-compassionate being. This leads to that kind of pseudo-speciation, it's called by anthropologists, making people who have another idea about life into like practically a different species,
right.
A different sensitivity.
Right, again.
And I beg you to think of the compassion of Jesus and realize that Jesus himself would go in there and would never turn away from such beings,
right.
Never.
That's
right.
Why I said to you, I mean, in an earlier part of the conversation, the Sermon on the Mount is very important, and it seems to me completely at odds with this idea of eternal.
Well, the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, Jesus says, we'll be guilty of the fire of hell. So to cite the Sermon on the Mount as against hell is not helpful.
Yeah,
however,
he's talking to scare some people to get them to shape up some simple-minded people. But that doesn't give you the license not to use your own intelligence to reinterpret things. People do reinterpret everything.
Right.
Religion is one long list of reinterpretation.
Right. Again,
do you think that Jesus spoke English in Elizabethan English?
No, he spoke Aramaic. I mean, this is knowledge. But
let me
just say one thing, and this is again a huge stumbling block to many people. And again, many people are sitting here, watching this dialogue and thinking, here we go again. This old battle comes up again. Where people just butt heads and there's no resolution to it. And I would submit, it is a difficult problem. I don't want to make it sound easy, make it sound like this trite thing of, again, this image of God that I feel like is so often promulgated. The popular idea of God is we see God, he's this loving being, we're drawn to this light, there's this loving fuzziness, vending machine, Santa Claus, all these kinds of things. The first step in really understanding Jesus' teachings. He has a great story about a person who comes to God and says, God, I thank you about all these things that I have. And there's another person who comes to God and says, he can't even look up to God and beats his chest and says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. The person who can come to the point where they can look at themselves and say, I deserve this. I really deserve it. My pride is crushed. I really understand the magnitude of what's inside me, the choices that I've made. And like I said, would join God in doing this to yourself. That is the first step. It involves a crushing of pride, and it involves a tremendous abrogation of many of the humanistic values that we hear today. And it's a hard stat, but I would submit to you that those who look at themselves and who really, really really introspect on their lives will come to that realization with an open mind.
I'm afraid we are out of time.